ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It's just your average suburb, but there's a whiff of someone playing silly duckers. Reg Grundy's kids' clothes and stuffed toys are going missing.
It's Leonardo da Vinci.
Hi, I'm Dr. Anne Jones, and I've secured an interview with Leonardo da Vinci, the criminal cat, thieving mastermind, for my podcast series, Nature's Most Wanted.
What the duck?
On ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm Claire Nichols, and this is The Book Show, where I bring you conversations with your favourite fiction authors. Later, I am taking you to Cottesloe Beach here on Whadjuk Noongar land. It's the setting of a new thriller by Emma Stiles. But first, the Australian author Deborah Adelaide is here. She's just published her 19th book, and this is a deeply personal work inspired by the lifelong friendship she shared with the late author Gabriel Carey. Gabriel Carey was a prolific writer, mostly of nonfiction, but most famous for the novel Puberty Blues, which she co-authored with Kathy Lett when the pair were just teenagers. Now, Gabriel Carey died by suicide in 2023 when she was 64 years old. And Deborah Adelaide has tried to make sense of her friend's life and death with this really beautiful book. It's called When I Am 64. And before we get started, I want to remind you that the number for Lifeline is 13 11 14. Hi, Deborah.
Hello, Claire.
When did you first meet Gabriel Carey?
I first met her when we were both in primary school, but I had very little to do with her because I was a bit of a newcomer. She'd been there well before me and she had her own established friends. But we became friends when we first went to high school, and literally on the first day of high school, when we both missed the bus going home. So we were kind of clinging together for comfort. And our friendships, I guess, consolidated because we both loved reading and we found ourselves to be somewhat outsiders in that school context. But yeah, so we were both 12.
Wow. What do you think made you two outsiders?
That high school was very typical of an outer suburban high school of its time, and it had a big emphasis on sport, and both of us were decidedly unsporty students, to say the least. And we both felt like misfits. In her case, I think it was partly because of her family background, which was, by comparison to everyone else's at the time, very radical and forward-thinking. And my background was incredibly sheltered, and we both just loved reading. And I don't remember anyone else at the time at school who loved reading. We were seen as oddities because we prefer to sit down and read a book than do almost anything else.
You would have seen her early success with Puberty Blues. You know, she published that when she was just a teenager. What was it like to witness that?
Well, I couldn't read that book for years and years and years. I was only on the margins of that experience that Gab and Kathy Lett wrote about, because they had a friendship that was quite different to the friendship I had with Gab. And they used to go to the beach together, and they were very much part of that surfy culture. And I didn't do that. I didn't participate in that beach culture at all. I didn't actually like going to the beach then. I found it, you couldn't read a book on the beach. It's still hard to read a book on the beach, you know, the wind and the sand and everything. So I knew they were writing it because Gab was in touch with me. And in fact, she asked me for some stories about our time back then, but she had obviously misremembered because I didn't have any stories to contribute because I didn't go to the beach with them. And then when it was finally published, I actually wasn't in touch with her at the time, and I was very aware of all the controversy about it, and I just thought, I feel I know what this book is going to be about, and I just couldn't bear to read it at the time. But I did eventually read it a few years later, and I've read it several times over the years.
What do you make of it?
Well, it's extraordinarily focused, and it's an amazing accomplishment for two writers who were so young. It is incredibly consistent. I think it's something to be enormously proud of. And I think Gab was, well, in fact, I know Gab was, she wanted to escape it. She wanted not exactly to disown it, but she felt that it was a youthful achievement and she'd moved on and she'd written much, much better books. I reread this book, as many people did, immediately after she died. And again, I was struck by how well written it is and just how consistently it offers this quite shocking story of how teenage girls were treated at the time, the early 70s.
Mm. So I understand you were in and out of each other's lives over the years. What did this friendship look like over a long span of time?
Well, it's like we were related by blood in that, you know, we were in each other's lives for so long that we took each other for granted. And, you know, losing her was like losing a very close member of my family. And I think we had that intimacy where we could actually not speak to each other for months and months, and it didn't make any difference at all. Neither of us felt we'd been neglected. You could just pick up the phone or send a text or send an email and you know, we would carry on. So I was actually thinking about this earlier this morning, and I feel, in a sense, we both took each other totally for granted. But in another sense, that was a good thing because it showed how close we were.
You are both writers. Would you help each other with your work? Would you look at each other's work?
In one sense, no. We did not talk about our private projects, our individual projects. We didn't show each other draft work. We didn't ask for help from either of us for anything that might have been difficult. But I had edited back in around 1990 the book she wrote about her father and his suicide, which is called In My Father's House, because I was working at that time as a freelancer. I also edited another book of hers that she'd written, a novel called The Borrowed Girl. And she contributed to books that I'd edited, and I contributed to a book she'd edited. So, you know, we shared those sorts of experiences, but I don't think it would have occurred to either of us to show each other drafts of works we were working on independently, mainly because neither of us worked that way. We both became used to working very independently. And I have some writer friends who are in writing groups and have been for years and years and years, and they find that very useful. I'm completely the opposite. It never occurred to me to be in that kind of group. So, and I think Gabrielle was very similar to that too.
Gabrielle Carey was suffering a deep depression, and I know you were really there for her in this time, Deborah Adelaide. Can you tell me how you cared for your friend during this time in her life?
Well, yes, I was there, and so were quite a few other friends and, of course, her family. And I have had a tiny bit of experience with trying to deal with people suffering from depression, trying to help them. And I find that there's very little you can do, but what I did discover that there were things that I needed to do, that she needed me to supply. One of them was just listening to the endless circular kind of discussions or conversations, or entering into those discussions and conversations about the same things, and just being patient in that sense, helping her with practical things like things around the house that she wanted help with fixing, and going for walks. And I describe this in the book, and I think it does become a bit of a theme and possibly also a structure for the book, us going on our walks. And we used to do this intermittently over the years anyway, but when she was so sick, she would say, look, a walk would really help, a walk would help. So we would go out for a walk, a long walk, and it would actually help. It would help lift her mood. but only temporarily.
So this novel, and I say novel, it's called When I Am 64. Probably best to call it autofiction, I guess. Why give this book the title of fiction as opposed to, say, a memoir, Deborah?
It's a great question, and it's something I've actually addressed directly in the back of the book in an afterword. It occurred to me when I was writing the early draft that it was a memoir but not a memoir, and I was just grateful that there was this term autofiction, whoever invented it years ago. I was very grateful for that because it helped me write the book because I felt I wasn't constrained to follow, as I would have in memoir, a linear storyline. I wasn't constrained to do research or obliged to do research. I wasn't obliged to endlessly check facts and secure correct dates of events. It gave me a freedom to explore the themes that I felt I needed to explore and to try and answer the questions, which is how I began the book, because I just had these questions about why. Why was she suffering? Why did she take her life? Questions that everyone who knew her and who was close to her had and probably still have. So that the autofiction approach gave me the freedom to do that. And if I'd been writing memoir, I would have attacked it in a very, very different way. I would have begun at the beginning. I would have started, with her birth or somewhere around her birth, her early life, her family background. And I wasn't interested in doing any of that for a whole lot of reasons. So I ended up with this hybrid work, which is obviously sticking very close to the truth and also includes material that I've massaged, I've rearranged, I've possibly exaggerated or minimised, and I have invented some things, but I haven't invented anything that's fundamentally contrary to the truth of the story of our friendship, our relationship, her sickness and her death.
And you make the decision in When I Am 64 to not name Gabrielle Carey. You refer to her as my friend. Kathy Lett is my friend's other friend. Why make that choice?
Again, I was trying to get away from the constraints of memoir, but I also felt towards the end of writing this book especially that I was not just writing about one particular person, but I was writing about a whole lot of people who've suffered depression and have taken their lives. I was also writing about the writing life. There's a lot of content in the book about what it means to be a writer, the practical challenges, the joys, the frustrations of being a creative writer. And I felt that that has more appeal, broader appeal. So it wasn't just about me, not just about Gabriel, but about a broader, possibly about a broader kind of community of readers and writers. But I'm aware that most people will pick this up and read it as memoir, and that is absolutely fine. I know I have no control and shouldn't have any control over the reader.
You talked about the questions you had about Gabrielle Carey, you know, why did she take her life, you know, what was going on? But I think this book also, you're asking questions of yourself, Deborah. There's some really poignant moments of regret, you know, where the narrator is saying, why didn't I follow up that conversation? Why didn't I ask more? What was it like to confront those regrets?
Well, as you can imagine, that's very painful. And of course, I'm not the only one. Other close friends and her family have been asking themselves the very same questions. In my case, I had, for example, I mentioned the book of hers that I'd edited that she wrote about her father and his suicide years and years ago.
At the same age, right, at the age of 64.
Exactly the same age, yes. And I hadn't reread that when Gabrielle was sick. I reread it after she took her life, and I just nearly kicked myself thinking, why didn't I think to reread this? But I thought I knew it well. I thought I knew it really well. But there was stuff in there that I hadn't remembered, and there were details in there that I felt gave me some clues or insights into why she felt as ill as she did, why she was obsessed with the issues that she was obsessed with, and why ultimately she took her life. And I do have a huge regret that I didn't reread it, and I might have had a bit of insight, and that might have helped. Who knows?
I mean, the thing about regret, I guess, is it's not a very useful emotion, is it?
It's not useful at all, but it's inevitable when you're in this situation. I think it's a normal process to go through, that you just go back over and over and over conversations and events and think, what could I have done better? What could I have said that would have helped? I think everyone who's lost someone in these circumstances experiences this. It's just part of the process.
There's a line in the book where the narrator, or you, Deborah, are thinking about Gabrielle and her dad, and you write, "I made a huge mistake thinking that since it was long past, since we used to talk about it a lot, since she had written about it, it was settled in her mind." That line really jumped out to me, because I think we do get a sense, and probably on programs like this, when we talk about things like we had an issue, we wrote about it, and now we can move on. Of course, that's not always the case, right?
Exactly. And again, this is one of the insights that came to me too late. I was convinced that she had, in a sense, got over her father's death. And no one gets over a death like that. But I had felt that she'd processed it, that she'd come to terms with it, and it wasn't affecting her life, and it wasn't part of why she felt the way she did. It wasn't part of her mental illness in that final period of her life. But again, rereading the book in my father's house, things just leapt out at me, and it was like she was repeating the same obsessions to the extent that she was saying the same kinds of things that she reported on her own father saying all those years ago.
So these were obsessions, like she was obsessed about money. She thought, you know, she didn't have enough to live on. She was worried about the house, those sorts of things.
Yes, yes. About being too poor, about being a failure, of all things. And I put this to her and said, how can you even think that, you know, with all your achievements, all the books you've published, all the readers you've given such a joy to, the literary awards, the beautiful family you have. I mean, she would then kind of back off when I would say these things to her. But I realised that it was still very, very much prevalent in her mind, that she had this very, very strong sense that she'd failed people, she'd failed herself, she'd failed everyone. And this is something that she reported on her father also feeling and saying to his family.
Mm. We were talking about this idea of writing about something and then this assumption that you've then dealt with it. And it seems silly to ask the same question of you, Deborah, but has writing this book helped you to cope with the loss of your friend?
Yes, it has in many ways. It has helped. I think if I hadn't been writing this book, I wouldn't have been, for example, examining Gabrielle's publications with such a critical eye. I wouldn't have been rereading them with a view to extracting truths from them. I wouldn't have been reflecting on the things that I reflected on, and I wouldn't have been consciously bringing up the memories that I did to put into the book. And I feel, and I think I say this somewhere in the book, I feel I arrived at some answers. I'm not sure that they're the right answers, but they're answers that satisfy me. And so that has helped me cope with the trauma of this event. But, you know, as you know, you never really cope. Mm. You know, it's a trauma that you just learn to manage it, I expect.
And it's striking, Deborah, that this book, When I Am 64, is a book written kind of in the style of a Gabrielle Carey book, right? This kind of very deeply personal, memoirish work. It is almost something like a book that she would have written.
Well, in terms of the content, yes, you're absolutely right. In terms of the style or the voice, I think it's very, very different to hers. In fact, I know it is. But in a sense, during the writing of this book, I was saying to myself, why am I doing this? Why am I writing this book? You know, this is ridiculous. But by the time I came to the conclusion of the book, I realised I was writing it for the very simple reason that she couldn't write it for herself. And I was left behind, so now I would do it. Because she would have interrogated this aspect of her life. She would definitely have written a book, if she could, about her suffering, about her mental illness, about her struggle to come to terms with her father's suicide. She absolutely would have written a book about that. And so I came to the conclusion that, well, I was here and I was the writer and I was the friend and I was the one who'd known her since we were both teenagers, so perhaps it was up to me to write it.
I know a big part of this project is about celebrating Gabrielle Carey and her work. What do you want people to know about her literary contribution to the world?
Well, her contribution was a body of work, 9 books, I think, that were all based on her life, whether they were fiction or not. And they were frank, they were straightforward, they were beautifully crafted, and they looked at difficult issues. They discussed painful things. I mean, she had a lot of sadness in her life, and she coped with a great deal of trauma. And I think people who've lost someone to suicide, people who've gone through a family breakup as she did as a teenager, people who've nursed their mothers through illnesses and had to cope with their deaths, even at an age where Gabrielle's mother was, and her mother Joan was an extraordinary woman who does feature in the book, because I knew her really well. But even Joan's death in her late 80s was still a traumatic one for Gabrielle. These are all things that people go through every day. And Gabrielle had a knack and a skill, more than a knack, a skill of focusing on the personal but making it universal. And I think that was a great legacy she left. And at the same time she was publishing these books that were so intimate, I would be cringing, saying, how on earth can you do this? How can you write about your family? And she'd just say, oh, well, that's just what I do as a writer, because it was very, very different to me. And I think that's one of the reasons I wanted to make this book, which is deeply personal, not that intimate. So I didn't want to draw in details of myself and my life, my family's life. And it's one of the reasons I think I chose not to use any names in the book, as you mentioned earlier.
Well, it's a beautiful book, and Deborah, I really think you're a wonderful friend. Thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you so much, Claire. It's been a real pleasure.
And When I Am 64 by Deborah Adelaide is published by UQP. And a reminder, if this has been a difficult interview for you, please remember that the number for Lifeline is 13 11 14. On ABC Radio National, you're listening to The Book Show with me, Claire Nichols. And we're out of the studio right now. We're at Cottesloe Beach in Perth in Western Australia. I've got the wind in my hair. I'm looking out at the beautiful blue Indian Ocean. And I'm here to meet the author Emma Stiles, who grew up around Cottesloe. And she's written a new book about this place that gives it a pretty creepy treatment. It's called The Shark. Emma Stiles, thanks for letting me visit you down at the beach today.
Claire, it is so good to be here. Thank you for inviting me to the beach today.
And this is Cottesloe Beach, like probably one of the most iconic beaches in Western Australia, probably in Australia. What do you think makes this place so special?
I think it's a whole combination of things. I think Cottesloe Beach has the beautiful grass terraces, the incredible Norfolk pines. It has its little shark net there. It's a beautiful sheltered beach for families, but then you can not very, you know, within a short distance, you can find your own stretch of beach and, yeah.
And you can look out, I think we've got container ships out on the ocean today, and we can see Rottnest Island watching up over there as well.
Always. And it's very clear today. Yeah, I love seeing that those container ships at gauge roads where they tend to park up. Like, I don't know really anything about container ships, but they're just such a, they're such an iconic WA thing, right, that you would always look out there towards Wadjimup and see them. And so, yeah, they're like a thing I remember from my childhood.
Did you grow up around here?
Well, yeah, I was born in the UK. We moved here when I was 9, and the first place we moved was Cottesloe. We rented a place on Pier Street, which is a street I talk about in the book. So that experience of moving from the UK and finding I was living on a street with the Indian Ocean at the bottom of the street was just mind-blowing for me. So, yes, those very early memories of WA are looking at this view and swimming on these beaches. Also, I remember one of the first things, it just happened, it was random, but actually it was really good. One of the first things I remember learning at primary school was all the things in Western Australia that could, all the wildlife that could harm, severely harm or possibly kill you. So that was a shock to the system.
So okay. I guess you got taught about sharks.
We totally got taught about sharks. Yeah, I just remember, even this was grade 5, so I just even remember being shown footage of like people who'd been like stitched up after shark bites and things. So that was all a bit of a shock.
Do you still think about that? Like if you get into the water, do you think about sharks?
I think about sharks every time I get into the water. But that's partly, I mean, I think I might have got the memory slightly wrong, but I feel like I remember exactly where I was the day that Ken Crew was attacked and died literally on this beach. I was in the UK by then. And it feels to me, even though there were many after that, that feels like there's a big before and after that.
This is such a sunny, beautiful place. You know, even right now we can hear the families playing, the people are running along the beach. It's such a gorgeous spot. But you've talked about the sharks.
Yeah.
There is that slight sense of menace.
Yes.
This is also a part of Perth where we have historically had a couple of really high-profile serial killers active in the area. How does that dichotomy work for you, the kind of sunniness of this place and then the slight perhaps seediness or scariness of it?
It totally works for me as a writer, okay? And so, I mean, growing up here, yes, we arrived here. I thought, okay, I've landed in paradise. And it is paradise in so many ways. And then, yes, we had those experiences in the 80s and 90s, and by the time the Claremont murders were happening, I had moved away. I was back in the UK. But all my family, my sisters, my friends were here. They were hanging out in the same places that those girls were going missing from. And that, I think for me being away, it was almost more frightening. So that every time I came home, I was super aware of it. When I was away, I was super aware of it because I was worrying about people. So yeah, that just stayed with me. That dichotomy totally stayed with me, and it was probably a no-brainer that one day I would not write a book about that, but that sense of being in a community where there's a killer out there somewhere in plain sight for such a long time, you know, and yet everyone is still, of course, going about their things that they love to do in the same way that they always have, because you don't want to stop doing, you don't want to stop doing life, right? So, and because it was such a long time for the Claremont murders, over 20 years, you know.
You live in Sussex, I believe, in the UK.
Yes.
And it sounds like you have spent a lot of your life in the UK. Why are you still writing a novel about Perth and Cottesloe?
I started writing out of homesickness for WA. So, and that was in the late 90s when I had only been in the UK for maybe 5 years or so. And I thought I was coming home. I always thought I was coming home. I still think I'm coming home. Okay. So that probably sounds crazy, but I started writing out of homesickness for WA, and that helped me stay connected to the place. But I never took it seriously. I never imagined I would write a novel until I had this moment when I was standing in line at the Perth Writers' Weekend for Sean Tan to sign a book for me that I had bought. And I just had this light bulb moment. It was like one of the, it was weird. It's one of the happiest moments of my life. Because I think when you get an idea that you're going to do something, before you've realized how hard it's going to be, that's almost the best moment. You just, you know, it's like a gold, that moment is like a golden moment in my memory.
What was the idea?
It wasn't that it was a particular book idea. It was just, I need to write a novel. It was only that. And because I had been on that weekend, I'd been going to a lot of events with writers and illustrators. I was there with my mum, and my mum paints and draws. So we happened to go to those things. So initially I thought I was going to write children's books. And I did. I came back to the UK and I spent like 10 years writing children's books and not getting them published, which was probably a good thing. And most of those were young adult novels. And each time I wrote one, the stories would get a bit darker, the characters would get a little bit older, and crimes were beginning to happen. And then it was only when I wrote what became my debut novel, No Country for Girls, that I was told, that was because I was writing that book on a course, I was pretty well told by one of my tutors, Emma, this is not a young adult novel. This is an adult crime novel with teenage protagonists. And that was such a great moment for me because I realised, oh, that was a thing that you could do, you know. And it freed me up totally. Bad shit happens. There's lots of swearing. I didn't have to worry about any of that stuff. But I still love that. I'm still fascinated with the teenage experience. So I always, so far. It is true that my characters still get a little bit older each time I write a book, but yeah, they are young women.
Yes, and let's meet the young women in this novel, The Shark. So we have Rach. She's about 19. Yeah. She's just finished high school, and she is hunting a serial killer. She is walking these streets that we are sitting on right now, and she is actively trying to find a serial killer. Why?
She is. So Rach is this raging, grieving character whose first love, Piper, was probably a victim of this killer, but Piper's body has never been found. Rach is, takes frustration to a new level, really. So that's her plan. When the book opens, she says, I'm going to make him tell me to my face what he did with her. So she says, even if it's the last thing I ever do, I'm going to be taken by this serial killer. So that's what she does.
It's a bizarre mindset. It's not even to seek justice. It's like, I'll probably die, but I just need to look him in the eye and find out what happened. Yeah.
And that's what's one of the really interesting things for me is that, you know, certainly, I think once the publisher got hold of it, and then once reviewers and reviews come in, everyone's like, this is a revenge story. This is a revenge novel. And I never would have in a million years set out to write a revenge story. It's just not my thing. Like, I do not recommend revenge as a human, you know, endeavor. Just don't do it. And I think the thing with Rach is it didn't start out that way. It started out as this, as someone wanting answers. And Carmen too, who's the other main character who Rach meets, and they end up forming this uneasy alliance. Carmen wants answers too. Neither of them are driven by revenge, but then events kind of take over.
Yeah, at some point it probably turns from seeking answer to some sort of perhaps vigilanteism. Like, how slippery is that slope?
Well, I think it's an extremely slippery slope, but that's because I've written these two characters who are literally on the slippery slope. This is not, you know, through personal experience, fortunately. But one of the UK bloggers who recently really loved the book, she described this as two women taking justice into their own hands badly. And that was so, so great. Because, and I just said to her, oh my God, that should be like on the cover of the book, because they really do mess things up really, really badly.
I'm so glad you said that, Emma, because Rach and Carmen are teenagers.
Yeah.
They've been dealt difficult hands in life. They have challenges with their mental health. They have unstable family situations. They're also, like all of us were when we were teenagers, making bad choices. What is it like to deal with two protagonists who make really tricky choices?
I kind of love it, to be honest, because some of those choices I know they're going to make before we start. Like, I have a bit of a plan. I'm not an obsessive planner, so I don't plan out every stage of the book. But the big choice I knew they had to make was that they were going to abduct and imprison and question the prime suspect in this case. I knew they were going to do that. In fact, it was probably the whole start of the story idea for me. And then what I had to do was I had to dig down into each of them, because it had to be vaguely credible that they would each do that. And then you have just outlined all the reasons that they do that, how all the reasons that they're in such, you know, crucial, chaotic, on-edge situations in their lives. But then, of course, when you start writing, they make their own decisions, you know? And that's the thing. That was probably one of the best things about writing a novel, because you've got all this, you've got scope, you've got time for your characters to make those bad decisions, which if you're a crime writer, that's perfect, because you really need them to do that.
Okay, so we've got Rach and we've got Carmen. Carmen, I think her home situation is a total mess.
Yes.
What do we need to know about this character, Carmen?
Carmen is repeating high school because of a period of time she spent on a psychiatric ward, which was 3 months. And this was after an incident where she's adopted into this family, her older adoptive sister Alexis has really bullied her since she was a baby, pretty horribly. And then there was this incident, and initially you don't really know what happened. All you know is there was this thing that Carmen calls that night, which she can't remember clearly, and she ended up on this ward for 3 months, which is where she briefly met Rach. Rach was only in there for 3 days. And you also know quite early on that she does feel some kind of connection with this killer. But because she frequently dissociates, and then so her memories are extremely unreliable, and she's not really sure, certainly at the beginning, she's not really sure what went on that night or what that has to do with this series of murders.
I should say this serial killer prowling Cottesloe is known in the media as the Shark. And in one of my favourite character details, the character of Carmen carries this tin of shark teeth around with her all the time. It's so creepy, Emma.
It is creepy. It is creepy.
I love reading fiction set where I live. There's something really thrilling about opening a book and seeing Cottesloe Beach on the pages. But I have to say, Emma Stiles, after reading The Shark and coming here to meet you today, I turned onto Marine Parade here along the ocean, and I felt a bit squeamish, because you've made this such a dark and dangerous place in your novel. What's it been like for you to come back after having written this novel in the UK, to come back and see this place after giving it this treatment?
It has also been quite creepy, which I did not expect, right? I came down on Friday night with my mum, and it was creepy. It was just after sunset, so it was really busy. So there's heaps of people around, and I went for a dip outside the shark net, as you do sometimes. Everyone else I could see was swimming inside the shark net, but I thought, no, I'm channeling my characters here. Yeah, so that was a mildly nerve-wracking experience, because honestly, the ocean was already dark, and that probably wasn't the best idea. But also, just walking the streets And despite how busy it was, I felt like, oh, you know, I have captured the vibe of something in this book. And it was just really, I was just really aware of it.
Your book is called The Shark. It's published by Sphere. Emma Stiles, it's been lovely to meet you today.
Claire, thank you for having me so much. It's been great to talk to you, and it's especially been great to talk to you right here.
And next time, please swim inside the shark net.
Okay.
You've been listening to The Book Show. Remember, you can follow the program on the ABC Listen app so you do not miss a conversation. Thank you to producer Anita Barrow. We make The Book Show on the lands of the Wurundjeri and Whadjuk Noongar people.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.